Well, tonight, as we proceed through at least these earlier chapters of Nehemiah, we come to chapter 2, the last part of it, verses 11 to 20, and the title is this, Assessing the Scale of the Work. Assessing the Scale of the Work. We've seen earlier that bold action on the part of Nehemiah, bold to present his requests to King Artaxerxes, had led to a great result. There had been a good outcome. And the king, who might have fired Nehemiah on the spot, but daring to come, bringing some of his own personal troubles, as it were, to work, having a look and countenance that was sad when his duty was to be the life and soul, as it were, before the king. But no, the king was anxious to know what was the trouble, because Nehemiah was a man of good and solid character and somebody that the king wanted to know more about, cared for him. And so Nehemiah explains the situation in Jerusalem. The king is moved, queen also, and Nehemiah is able to go to his own country, getting some leave of absence as the cupbearer to the king, his usual duty, and assigning a time when he would return, but also with help. He has letters to give to potentially troublesome governors in some of the regions that lay between Persia and Jerusalem to make sure that these governors, who in the past had tried to thwart the building of the temple and the re-establishing of Jerusalem to preempt any further trouble that they might seek to stir up, that the king himself was with the mission of this man and had given him full authorization to proceed on to Jerusalem. Furthermore, to have the right to command would be made available for the rebuilding of the gates and the walls that they were about to embark upon. He also provided him with an escort, and so in many ways Nehemiah got even more than he had asked for. The king was very anxious that his servant, whom he valued and esteemed, and whose work, well, he would credit as being worthwhile, should be helped in his work. But as we saw, as we finished, there was also opposition. And that same opposition manifests itself again, becomes more vocal, as we'll see at the end of this passage. Well, the first heading is this, a time for quiet reflection. Time for quiet reflection. Verses 11 to 16. That Nehemiah did not rush on with the work, but he did a full kind of damage estimates. He had a good time to settle in, 3 days before he actually did anything, acclimatizing himself, just becoming familiar perhaps with some of the people, getting to understand some of the ways, seeing the morale of the people, how they actually were in themselves, and therefore being able to better gauge how he might approach them when the time should come. So he had time to look, time to reflect. We never do well if we rush. We never do well if we haven't perhaps given ourselves a little time to observe and reflect carefully what might be the best approach here. Otherwise, the work will be more likely damaged, or any good that we might have sought to do will be undone by that. And he's looking for perspective. Perspective on the city, present state, its people, who they are, what makes them tick, and then to be able to assess more clearly how much work needs doing, how best to actually go about it. So he spends those 3 days just in the city, just observing, just getting to know people and picking up something of the mood and the state of morale. But then the time comes for him to visit the walls, and we read about how he travelled there, only one animal with him in that way, and a few other people, but for the most part on his own, in different locations he mentions, like the Valley Gate, the Serpent Well, the Refuse Gate. He did a thorough search, in other words, observed the gates, observed the walls, and, well, he saw the rubble that was there. He saw just how bad it was. Hananiah's brother and the others who had visited to Shushan, where he was, as there, the news was brought to him about the the state of things, well, it was as he was told. And he can now see it for himself. And there are places in which the rubble is everywhere, collapsed everywhere, that hardly he could actually get through with the animal that he was riding on his tour of inspection. And this grieved him much to see. This is the distress that Jerusalem is in that he speaks about in verse 17. And his review, and he, of course, does it at night, doesn't he? Doesn't call attention to himself the time of day in which he does it. He does it at night, observed, so he can pass by unhindered, people not stopping, say, well, what are you doing? What's all this about? Fewer people there and speculation to start running, that could be dampened down. But a city without walls, well, damaged walls, was a poor city indeed in those days. That was an undefended city, like a country without an air force, got no way to defend itself against the likely attack that it would face. Because in those days, it would be ground forces coming. Well, you'd need walls, keep those people out, or make life very difficult for them seeking to gain entrance. And it was also, of course, important because the temple itself, now rebuilt, would be in jeopardy. It could be overthrown again. Another army could come, could overthrow the city, because there are no walls, no gates, could march through, and once again lay a hand upon the temple, bring it back to ruin. And so the temple itself, all it represented, and the hope of, well, the coming Messiah, and of how the worship of God was focused in that day, there in Jerusalem, and all the hopes that attended it. Well, it was a vital thing. And to protect it, defend it with a walled city, well, that was a vital thing. Country with no, or a city with no walls, well, a bit of a laughing stock, couldn't take it seriously. Had no pretensions to be a sort of world power if it didn't even have walls of its own, couldn't even defend itself. So what influence it might hope to have? Well, it was weak and feeble. And so it was imperative to do something, to have those walls rebuilt, the gates reset, so as to have the city defended. As we mentioned, he did this work at night and kept very secret to himself what it was that he was doing. Verse 16, all the officials, none of the Jews, the priests, the nobles, all of the people of the city, who eventually were the people who were going to do the work, but at that time he had not told them what it was in his heart to do. It was a time for quiet reflection. He wanted to see it for himself, to do it in a way that wasn't under the prying eyes or people pressurizing him or feeling as if they wanted a decision now, that he held his distance, kept his counsel, and had a good look. And there is time for that, time for calm reflection. There's a work ahead, or if we're embarked on something, just thinking of ourselves as a fellowship here, but whatever kind of thing we might be doing, as individuals, as households, there is a good time to be spent in quiet reflection, to assess, to see the situation as it is, and to see how best to proceed with it, particularly if it involves other people. So the second heading is this, seeing just how bad it is, seeing just how bad it is. Verses 13 really to 15, already alluded to some of the situation that Nehemiah encountered, the terrible state of the walls, the terrible state of the gates, burned with fire, the results of what Nebuchadnezzar's men had done to the city when they came, when they finally took it, and Zedekiah had fled, but to no advantage of his own, and finally the city was conquered and subdued. And this was the state in which it was left. Rubble. You could hardly pass through the place. It wasn't, well, you weren't able to ride your mule, as it were, through there, because everything was overhanging, bits hanging off here and tottering walls there. The whole thing presented in a very, very sorry state. And Nehemiah wanted to see it. He wanted to know. Couldn't afford not to. If he was to understand the scale of the work, then he needed to understand the scale of the problem. And that's the fact for us all. None of us can afford to live in a dream world. We can't afford to live in a dream world. We can't, for instance, in this day and this age, I would offer the thought, try to convince ourselves that things are not so bad. Well, I wonder at that. Otherwise, Nehemiah thought, well, it's not so bad, really. Ah, well, what do the walls matter that much? Well, then the work would never have got started. The city would have been left exposed. And Nehemiah would not have brought the level of urgency or been able to convey the seriousness of the situation, which galvanized the people, stirred up their hearts to work. Or if he had some rather a poor, deficient view of the sovereignty of God, that you just step back, all we need to do is just to pray and it will just happen. We don't have to do anything. That it will somehow attend to itself and we can abdicate any responsibility for ourselves, having to do any of the literal here, heavy lifting. Well, he couldn't afford to live in a dream world. He couldn't afford to let anybody else live in a dream world either. Because the situation was that the people had rather accommodated themselves to this new normal. That's how the city was, what could be done, and had rather acquiesced into the whole state of depression and sadness and of inactivity, hopelessness that had sort of fallen like a pall over the city. When Nehemiah wanted to assess the scale of the work so that he could then begin to communicate the vision, we'll see in a moment, that he had for the rebuilding of the walls. But, well, I suppose it has to be said that through the ages, the church, using the term in its widest sense, has often lived in a dream world, contented itself with thoughts that somehow everything was getting better when things palpably were getting worse, or that the church had been actually moving into being accommodating to the world, to the state of disrepair and ruin everywhere. The church simply hadn't realized that she'd lost her vocation and had moved away from scripture and what God's commission to her was, and had somehow just left behind a sense of the urgency because she herself was now part of the problem. We find for ourselves, don't we, here, that as we face the considerable challenge that we do, we cannot pretend that all is well. We cannot afford to live in a dream world in that way, that we are a small church, but a small company of people. We're stretched financially. That's why the report this morning of friendship and help of other people in other churches has been, well, very touching and very much confirmatory to us of true Christian fellowship and what it means and of the love of like-minded believers. And we really do honour such friends. But we know for ourselves, those things said, it's a serious situation. And within our company there, and again, we have to note the generosity of friends within the fellowship in that regard. But it is a work and a challenge that still lies ahead of us. And how we know if we extend beyond that and stray back into the territory of our series we did those mornings back in the autumn, where are we now? Well, we still are struggling with all the rotors, struggling with the lifts, struggling with the different aspects of maintaining the building and so forth. And for ourselves, we could say that, and we could say it for other churches too, and that it is a situation, much stress, much difficulty to maintain and continue in the manner that they are, with lack of helpers to do children's work, Sunday schools and such things, and that is not a comfortable place. And that's the reality. And we have to take stock of that, not despair in the midst of it, but be galvanized by it and pray in the midst of it. The Lord would do something wonderful, would do something good. But if we're not persuaded that things actually are as bad, or somehow something will just turn up like that and it doesn't really need any intervention of ours, well, we may be in for a bit of a disappointment or a bit of a wake-up on that. We need to be very vigilant. We need to be very much a praying people. And we need to assess, get the idea. It's a serious time that we as a fellowship are in. And we could extend that to our nation. I often think that our situation, the battle that we have to survive, to put it rather melodramatically, but I guess somewhere within that, there, the next 7-10 years or so, we've got a battle to survive. Well, it's a metaphor for our nation and how difficult and how poor the state of our nation is. How we might say there, the walls have been demolished, there have been gates have been taken down, the things that were a bulwark against damage to us and moral injury to us, well, we've been dismantled. Christianity has been made, as here by Tobias and Ballard, a kind of laughing stock, an object of derision. And people manifest a distinct hostility, speak very angrily about Christians and about morality that we call conservative morality. And that's the state that we are in as a nation, in the Western world in general. And we have to take stock of that. It will certainly and should stir us in our prayers and make us, well, very much out of dream world mode. We look and stare at what we do in the face. Atheistic, secular culture, Islam on the move, while one reads of radicalization of prisoners in various prisons where some of these jihadists are incarcerated and they're spreading their doctrine. And a recent report by the Ministry of Justice is flagging up. This is a serious problem. People are getting radicalized and moving out from there and mingling back with society. And it's not a very pleasant prospect. And so much of what we have done in dismantling what would have been a bulwark against such things, a true, robust Christianity, has been really over the years dismantled. People have allowed for a ridicule of the Bible, ridicule of Christian morality, have not thought that preaching and such things have any place, and certainly not to go in the open air and tell people about judgment and hell and wrath of God, that all of this must be consigned to some dustbin of history. But we've disabled ourselves and left ourselves as a society and a culture defenseless. No wonder that so many people are struggling, so many people are unhappy, profoundly sad, and particularly young people in that regard, we mention them with sympathy. So seeing just how bad it is and allowing ourselves to digest the implications, like Nehemiah does here, doesn't look around the city and think, touch of paint there would do, and perhaps just move a little bit of that mess here with a dustpan and brush, and well, it'd be all fine. He realized this is a very big work that lies ahead. It's gone a long way into disrepair, and it's going to need a real work to bring it back to where it needs to be. It was, of course, a famous reformer, Martin Luther, that when he saw just how bad things had become in the religious climate, the culture of his day, that he responded so strongly and vehemently with his 95 theses there attached to the Wittenberg Cathedral door as a basis for discussion, to stimulate a bit of a dialogue. And, well, we know one thing led to another, and led to the Reformation, as we call it. Perhaps in retrospect, we look on it and say, well, that was the Reformation. That was such a shake-up of the church, bringing her back to her vocation, back to the Bible, pushing away the accretions of the years, the traditions of men that had infiltrated. That one man, feeling and seeing the scale of the problem, scale of indulgences and how that provoked this man to action, couldn't bear it anymore. And we perhaps need to allow the day in which we are to touch us and to touch us to the quick, if you will, and to respond there with prayer, with diligence, and with renewed love for such a damaged, defenseless generation. So seeing just how bad it is, he took time to take that in, to have a good look at it in the face, to assess the walls, to look at the gates and see not how good they were, but how bad they were, to see how burned and destroyed the whole infrastructure of the city had become. So third heading is this, communicating the vision, communicating the vision. The time had come in verse 17 to report back to the people, to gather them together and to relay to them both what he had found, well, the scale of the problem, but also to point them forward to a solution, to paint for them a future in which they can make their contribution, in which they can be involved. So he reports back, and now is the time he reveals his hand. He's had his 3 days just to take in, as it were, the atmosphere, soak in the the kind of mood, understand where the people are, perhaps hear some of the defeatist and depressed talk, that kind of thing. And then done his own survey work and proceeded carefully, diligently to examine it. And now he's in a position to speak, to be able to speak authoritatively about the state of the city, but also to speak to the people before him, because he understands where they're at. He knows perhaps the state of inactivity and depression that they'd slumped into, and that he could now address them. And he does it not by way of rebuke. He doesn't come to them and chide them. How have you allowed it to become like this? Why did you tolerate this? Why has it needed me to come here and tell you what is plain obvious? He doesn't say anything like that at all. Neither does he somehow flatter them. We're saying things aren't so bad. No, he describes it as it is, and he invites them to share his perspective. You see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem, verse 17, lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. There it is, an accurate, factual, objective summary. Not rebuking them for it, not saying you're responsible for allowing this, why haven't you done anything before now, but inviting them to share his perspective, and really to see what is there to be seen, and that they could hardly really disagree with him. And his analysis, this is the distress that we are in. Well, there is perhaps somewhere within that there, a kind of mild rebuke to them that they had tolerated it, that they'd put up with it for so long as they had. But now he's speaking to them as one of them and inviting them, share the perspective that I am. And then, having fed back the reality, here comes then encouraging exhortation. Verse 18, come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. Come. An exhortation, not a rebuke, but an invitation to them to join with him, Nehemiah, not only in, that's the analysis, it's serious, this needs serious work to remedy, but come, let's be that remedy. Let's be those people who are going to rebuild those walls, those burned gates, who are going to really roll up their sleeves and get fully immersed, fully involved in rebuilding the walls of this city. And it is something that we remind each other of, that we, as it were, look to each other, say, come, come, let us do this thing, whether it is to literally have the rebuilding work done here, or at least in some measure, for us as a local fellowship, come, let us keep that standard that we have. Come, let us hold fast to the word of God, its authority, its sufficiency. Come, we're not seeing any huge success in our evangelism, but come, let us hold to it. Let's keep evangelizing. Let's keep preaching to this generation that God may yet open our heart, open our mind here, or more than that even. Come, let us pray. Let's keep praying for our generation, for our communities, our towns, for our nation. Not seeing the nation change, we're seeing it get worse, but there's no reason to stop praying. We pour out our hearts to God. This is the state. Our walls are collapsed, the gates are burned. But we look to each other and say, come, let's not just sink with this. Let's not just collapse under the weight of this. Let's not just give up because the work is too great. But let us be those who are going to stand. Let us be those who are going to walk in the ways of the Lord, who are going to seek to serve the purposes of God in our own generation. And that whatever we are, if we are to be, well, God forbid, but if we are the generation that sadly has to see the demise, the finish of this building, why even beyond that, the conclusion of this work, that we still say to each other, well, fight on, come. Somewhere else, somehow else, keep before the people of this community, beyond it, the witness to this truth. Come, let's not cease to pray for our nation. Come, let's not cease to honour God by the people that we are and the difference that we look to make, character, our demeanour, the way that we bear ourselves in such a fallen and sad generation, that we exhort each other. And of course, finally say, come. Let us keep going to glory. Let's keep walking that walk. Let's stir each other. The more as the day approaches to love and good works, let's hold before us ever the vision of glory to come, of heaven, and of our great God seated upon the throne, the Lord Jesus Christ, and all that he means to us. And we will see him, we'll be with him, and therefore eternity come. Let that stir us. Let that be something when everything else has failed. That is still burning strong within us. And within this, having exhorted them, and it's a big work, isn't it? Nehemiah's well aware just how great a work it is and just how great an involvement it's going to need from the people that he is addressing. But he's doing it with hope, because there he speaks in verse 18, how God has helped him, how he was before the king, and how the king gave him more than he requested. Indeed, didn't have him summarily executed for failing as cupbearer to maintain the positive attitude, the cheerful face that he was meant to keep. God had been with him. And we have to remember that also as we look back in providence, as we see the mercy of God to us in times past, why, even in the moment, and good friends both near and far who have contributed towards this building in the hope that we'll be able to make this thing move forward. And of course, it becomes more and more of a positive feel to that very possibility taking place. So we remember God's help, remember escapes from death, remember remarkable events, remember providences that just fell together in ways that you and I could never have imagined, whether in our own life or the life of this fellowship. And these are things that we ponder still and which we encourage each other with. Well, we're all part of the story of Christ Baptist Church. Some have been here longer than others, some parts of the history there and God's help in times past we're familiar with, and others of us are not familiar with. But it's had its twists and its turns. And here we are still by the grace of God. And we remark upon that, that the Lord's good hand has indeed been upon us. We've not come to revival, but we're still here. And the gospel is still preached, and we still have a living entity, a local church, with that love and commitment and with that willingness of heart which we see among us. Past mercies. And so we hold open that possibility. Might there not be another chapter to be written, in more than one chapter? May there not be further things, exploits to be done in the future? For it is a good work that we are about, and these things that God has laid upon our hearts, that they may yet have a wonderful fruition. So Nehemiah communicates the vision. Come, he says, let us rise up, let us build, let us see repair done, let us be that people who are going to stand before God, represent him, and have his work here prosper. Well, fourthly, finally, and as I hinted earlier, as we come to the opposition at the end, as the first half of chapter 2 finished about Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, and now Geshem the Arab joining with them in their distress, in their alarm. Somebody had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. It suited their purposes for them to be weak, for them to be manipulable, to be unable to raise a complaint against them, to be acquiescent and subdued, to have their city in a poor state so as to depress them, make them feel there's no future for you here, and keep them under subjection. So the fourth heading is this: remember the devil. Remember the devil. He was there, wasn't he, in 1 Peter chapter 5, as we read, that roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. But here, as we see, one of the devil's tools are these men, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, who heard of these things. Because the devil, well, what is their reaction? Well, they laugh, they despise, they charge them with rebelling against the king. That you're standing against the authority. That's the usual, the stock argument that's used, that somehow we pose a threat, we're divisive, we are introducing hate into our communities, into our culture. And so these people are bringing the same strategies of the devil to bear. Abuse, of calling the people stupid, crazy. What does the devil desire? Well, very straightforward, isn't it? He wants people to just collapse. He wants them to go down under the weight of his roaring, that they feel discouraged, depressed, that his fierceness and his strength kind of drains away the energy from the church. And that is what his desire is. And so we see it with Tobiah, we see it with Sanballat, and we see them putting before the people there, well, really? What is this thing you are doing? Is this credible? Is this going to have a future? Is it traveling anywhere? And was it really something that the king will be happy with? Does he countenance this? Well, aren't you just rebels? You've got your own program here and you're going to create trouble and you are going to report you for it. And so this is the devil's work. And he would like to introduce into us, into any believer or company of believers, despair in activity to make us prayerless, to rob us of any hope of anything ever happening anywhere, any time. And so that is his strategy. God, on the other hand, well, he would provoke us and he would give us no rest, but he would have us to pray and he'd have us search our hearts and he would have us to become more thinking as people, thinking about the people that we're trying to reach, thinking about the people that we are, how we present to them, how we come across and what we need to do to come over in a way more convinced, more calm, more relaxed maybe about the things we believe, not fazed. Roaring lion, we're not fazed by that. We don't wilt, we don't turn pale at it, but we're steadfast and we resist the devil. And so God brings into us that which he wants to do, to provoke us and stir us to love and good works towards a future, not to leave us discouraged and despairing. The devil wants us to be afraid, as a roaring lion seeks to do, doesn't it? It's a fearful thing, except he's toothless. He has no power against us, ultimately. He has nothing that he can do. We're in Christ Jesus, and he that is in us is stronger, greater than the one that is in the world, the devil. He wants to intimidate us. He wants to run false trails. He wants us to believe, oh, you dare. The authorities are beyond to you. You dare. Very often, of course, they are the people that rush to the authorities and start reporting this is what they're saying and hate speech here. And you get people running to complain about open air preachers and complain that they heard this, which they didn't hear, or accuse the preacher of saying something they hadn't said, but just as a way of trying to get them into trouble with the authorities and to get them silenced. Well, we look on these roaring lions, but with no power, and we can resist them steadfast in the faith. The devil wants to make us timid and afraid. He wants us to shrink back. He wants us to be discouraged, for our arms to grow limp, and for us to just roll over and die. That would be his strategy and his aim for us. But that's not the stuff that Nehemiah is made of. And he finishes there, doesn't he, by answering them. He answers them. He says, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. And those are the words, aren't they, just there? He's looking to God. He's not hearing their words. His focus is upon God, God of heaven. It's not their God. They've got no God of heaven on their side. And therefore he says, we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. What a distinction that he makes. Well, the church, much of the church, bent over backwards to bring in these people, these critics. Well, let's listen to them. We'll, in fact, give them a pulpit. Let's have them speak and tell us these things. And we'll sit under their strictures and feel very contrite and want to make reparations or want to do something here to make them all happy. And Nehemiah knows who he is. We are his servants. We're God's servants. We have a mission. We have a work to do. We have no truck with some of the great mistakes that our forebears have made and members of churches times past might have made. But we are here now. We're arising. We're building. We've got a work to do. You, he says, have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Imagine it. All these bishops with all their liberal views and promoting all these kinds of things, to be told, you have no part in the church, you do not belong here, you have no heritage, you have no portion among us. Well, those are weird words indeed. Well, we'd be accused of being divisive, and any bishop that dared say that would be hounded out. They'd have every newspaper there, or serious quote-unquote newspaper after them, having dared to perhaps offer the thought that you don't belong here. Your attitudes, your teaching puts you outside the pale of the church. It doesn't put you inside the pale of the church. Swedish bishop, a woman who identifies as lesbian, and said she feels more in common with Islamic people than she feels with evangelicals. That was her view. And of course, a little comment or two to come. Well, such people, we would have to say, have no heritage, all right, or memorial in Jerusalem. And Nehemiah was not too shy to say it, and to say to Sanballat and these people, we're not impressed. We don't think you actually belong amongst this. And we are building a work here without reference to you, without any particular take from you. We have no interest in your views and your words. We're focused on what we are doing. So remember the devil, because the devil remembers us, and he has not slept, and he does not sleep. He remains ever our adversary, ever on the go, as it were, looking to stir us to depression, despair, to move us into a state of apathy and lethargy and activity. Well, God would have us still be like Nehemiah. We're looking to the God of heaven to prosper us. May that yet transpire to be the outcome for us, local fellowship. We extend that to myriad other local fellowships who have a similar story to us. And we're assessing the scale of the work is quite sobering. But where we know we have a great God, we may have many other chapters yet to write in our future and in the future of those causes too that we are aware of. Amen.